This is a Hashkafa Shir for Parshas Bahar. The Parsha presents the Issa, the prohibition of ribis, and this is in Perek Chaf Hei of Vayikra, and it starts in Pasuk Lamed Hei. B'chi amuch achicha umata yodo imach. Your friend, your brother, is having trouble financially. He's literally falling apart. V'chzaktabo, you can strengthen him. You can extend an arm, a helping arm to him, ger v'toshav v'chei imach. And what the parasha is referring to is halva, extending a loan to your fellow Jew. Al tikach mi'ito neshech v'sarbis. Do not take neshech and tarbis, these are different kinds of usury, of interest. V'yoresam elokecha v'chei achicha imach. And you should fear your God, and your brother shall live with you. Allow him to live. Extend a loan. Give him that opportunity to pay back the loan without having to pay interest. Let's think about this mitzvah. A person could take his money, and he can deposit his money in a bank and he will receive interest. Why? Because he gives the bank the rights to use his money. The bank, in a commensurate way, pays him back by giving him ribis so that the bank could make a profit on his funds. Why should he give away his funds gratis without receiving payment for that? He's tying up his funds. It makes absolute sense that he should receive payment for that. That's ribis. And no one sees any sort of unethical act in receiving ribis and taking interest. Both sides agree, and the logic really compels it and justifies it. After all, why shouldn't I be paying you for the use of your money, or you paying me for the use of my money? And yet, our Torah sees in taking ribis a negative action and prohibits it. And we'd like to understand, on a hashkafic level, that's the subject for today, why the Torah sees something evil in taking interest. In fact, if you take a look at the Mishnah, at the beginning of Masechta Makis, on Daf Gimel, with regard to the case of Edim Zomimim, Reuven demands payment, repayment of a loan from Shimon. And Shimon counters and he says, yes, I borrowed from you, I have to pay you, but the time for payment has not yet arrived. At that point, Reuven, the plaintiff, invites two witnesses to testify on his behalf that according to the terms of the agreement, the loan, the time of payment has arrived. And therefore, at this moment, Beis Din hands down a verdict based on the evidence of these two witnesses, their testimony, that Shimon will have to immediately return the money. And now, two witnesses come in, and they testify against the first two witnesses that the latter perjured themselves. Imanu Ayisem, you couldn't have been there to witness the loan. You couldn't have possibly testified to that. In fact, you were with us in a different place at that same time. And the Torah in such a case says, we believe the second pair of Edom against the first. V'asisem lo kasha zomim lasos li'achiv. And we punish the Edom zomimim for the equivalent commensurate to what they tried to impose on the Nidon. Now, in this case, both pairs of witnesses are in agreement, and even Shimon himself is in agreement, that Shimon owes money to Reuven. The only difference is that, according to the first pair of Edom, who subsequently became Edom Zomimim, Reuven has to return the money immediately. And in fact, according to Shimon, he has another 10 years on the loan. And now Reuven, by invoking the testimony of these two witnesses, was able to prove in Beis Din that instead of paying back this loan 10 years down the line, he'll pay back the loan immediately. That's what he has to do. So Shimon, at the end of the day, will return the loan, but he can hold on to the money for 10 years. So what the Edim Zomimim really caused, as far as Shimon is concerned, is not a loss of money per se, but a loss of use of the money, if you will, for that extended period of 10 years. How do we implement the law of Asisim Lo Kashazom? What punishment, what penalty should we impose upon Reuven? I should say the Edim of Reuven, the Edim Zomimim, insofar as they perjure themselves on a loan, which in any event Shimon has to pay back. No one denies that. And the whole issue, does Shimon have to pay back now or in 10 years down the line? So how do we evaluate the loss that Shimon suffers as a result of the Eid Sheker, the false testimony of the Edim Zomimim? And in fact, the Mishnah says that in such a case, Omdim, we evaluate Kama Adam Rotzel Litain via Biyodo Elef Zuz. How much would a person pay? How much is it worth a person to have the benefit of holding on to his friend's money, 1,000 zuz in this case, Bain, and here are the two choices. And he has to figure out the difference between them. How much is that difference worth to him? Nosna Mikan Viad Lamed Yom. In case number one, he receives the benefits and the loan of 1,000 zuz for 30 days, as opposed to getting that loan for a full 10 years. How much is 10 years worth of use of 1,000 zuz worth on the market? Give it a price tag. But we see quite clearly that the halacha, the mission itself, recognizes the fact that holding on or being able to use someone else's cash is worth money on the market. It's Shavu Kesef. And therefore the Edim Zomimim, under the law of Kashas Zomim, have to pay for that loss of use of money, which is evaluated on the market. So let's say, for example, I would pay you 100 zuz in order to enjoy the benefit of 1,000 zuz that you're giving me for a period of 10 years. That 100 zuz really represents ribis, in a sense, because that's what ribis is. But clearly the halacha recognizes the validity of ribis and the value of holding on to someone else's mamon. So therefore, if we swing back to our parsha in Bahar, why does the Torah prohibit that which is logical, that which is justified? It's tzedek. It's within the moral law. Well, why then is there an isur on the malve, on the lender, to take ribis from the borrower? Now, let's leave this question on the side. Many Mefarshim address this question, but let's pick up a different question. And what I'd like to show you here on the bottom of page 147 in Hemi and Achamuni is the bottom paragraph, in which he speaks about the period of time in Jewish history back in Europe between the First World War and the Second. In Poland, the Jews were suffering tremendously from poverty, and as a result, it was quite frequent that Jews were not able to pay rental fees that they owed to the landlord. And what would happen is the landlord would have recourse to evict the sochrim, those who were renting, because they weren't paying. And in such a case, a Jewish family that was about to be thrown out into the streets without a roof over their heads would turn to the Jewish community and elicit funds in order to save them. The Jews inevitably would come to protect a fellow Jew. They would gather together funds in order to pay back the landlord the rental fees that are owed, so that this family could remain in their apartment, even if for one more month. And perhaps what we're going to see here is that with regard to ribis, that's our ultimate goal, there's a certain parallel between the Torah's logic and human logic, between Torah ethics and human ethics. And although there's a certain element of common, you know, lowest common denominator, nevertheless, on an ethical level, despite the similarity and the comparison, there is a stark contrast. So in order to demonstrate this, and explain the nature of the law prohibiting ribbis, we want to tell a story about two Gera Hasidim. One was the landlord, and the other was the renter. And the renter, of course, was very poor. He was a Gera Hasid like the landlord. But after a number of months in which the renter could not pay the rental fees, he wasn't paying up his monthly rental, the landlord, the Baal Bais, had no choice, but he began threatening the renter that if he doesn't pay, he's going to have to take him out, evict him from the apartment. That's the Minig HaMakom. And the renter was, of course, in a state of anguish. Imagine getting an eviction notice and you and your family have to find yourself a roof over your head. I mean, it's hard to even imagine the anguish and the suffering. So this socher, this renter, turns to the Ger Rebbe. He was known as the Imre Emes. And he told him the whole story. The Rebbe said to the chassid, to the renter, he said, "Let me calm you down. Let me take care of it." And at that point, he summoned none other, of course, than the landlord, the Baal Bais, to come in to see him. And when the Baal Bais came in, the Rebbe turned to him and he warned him that he shouldn't have the chutzpah to take this socher, this renter, and his family and throw him out into the streets. So to this, the landlord responded, "But Rebbe, I'm also a person. And the Minig HaMakom is that if a renter doesn't pay, then we threaten to throw him out of the house. Let the Jewish people collect that funds as a charity campaign in order to pay me out. Because otherwise, I have to personally carry the financial burden and the loss of whatever number of rubles it was per month. Why do I have to suffer? Why shouldn't the Jewish community as a whole participate in the suffering, in the financial loss of the renters who cannot pay?" So the Rebbe answered the following. Let's learn together a mission in the fourth parak of Gittin. Misha chetzio eved v'chetzio ben chorin. An eved that was owned by two partners, and one partner freed half of the eved. We're talking here about an eved Knani. The eved now has the status, insofar as he's still owned, or shall we say half of his body, his identity is owned by one of the two partners who did not free him. And at this particular point, the eved is in a bind. He's in a no man's land. He's not here and he's not there. What do I mean? He cannot marry a shivcha because half of him is a ben chorin, is a full-fledged Jew, and a full-fledged Jew can't marry a shivcha. On the other hand, the other half of him is an eved, so he can't marry a Yisraelis because that would be an isolav of kedesha. So this chatzi eved, chatzi ben chorin, that was initially owned by partners, by shutfin, and one shutfin freed his half, is now in an impossible situation vis-a-vis the mitzvah period of procreation and marriage. So the Mishnah establishes kofinis rabo v'ososo ben chorin. The Bezdin is mandated to force the other owner, the other partner who still owns his half of the eved, to free the eved, meaning free his half, in order to facilitate the ability for the Eved to become a full Ben Chorin, a Ger Gomur, a full convert, and marry a Jewish girl. And the truth is that although it was initially Beis Shammai that advocated Kofinis Adam L'Shar Charas Eved, that we forced the master to free his half, ultimately the Sugya tells us that even Beis Hillel, you know, came around to the view of Beis Shammai. They both agreed unanimously that this is what has to happen. We absolutely compel the owner of the last half of the Eved to free his half in order to facilitate the ability for the Eved to marry a Jewish girl. Now, let's think about this. The partner that owns half the Eved is going to take a tremendous loss now Again, hopefully he'll be reimbursed by the Eved later on when he achieves his freedom. But for the meantime, you know, there's no salvation in sight here, and it would seem that the owner, insofar as he has to give up his ownership of half the Eved, is now going to suffer a loss. So the Ger Rebbe now turns to this renter and he says, how do you learn this Mishnah? Why should the Adon, I mean, what's he guilty of? Why should he take this financial loss for the sake of the Eved, period of Arivia? What about the community? I mean, here you have a poor person. Let the community as a whole shoulder the financial burden of this situation, of this Eved, this Chatzi Eved. Why didn't Chacham make a takana, for example, that we should take up a collection, you know, a magbit? Every member of the Jewish community should pay X amount of zuzim in order to free the Eved, so that the Eved could fulfill the mitzvah of lo so brah l'sheves yisrael to procreate. Says the Ger Rebbe, beautiful Vardi, he says, what you see from this Mishnah is that if HaKadosh Baruch Hu set up in His divine providence a situation in which a mitzvah of supporting someone and helping him financially comes knocking on your door, on the door of a person, then that's not coincidental. Providence is turning to you, putting the finger, you know, pointing the finger at you and saying you are solely responsible to shoulder this burden, and you have to do this mitzvah b'shleimus in a complete way. The Torah is anticipating that you, insofar as you are the owner of half the Eved, you will be responsible to achieve this mitzvah. And the Torah is not willing to settle for anything less. No one else is going to have to participate, and the community is not going to chip in for the sake of the period of the Eved. The Torah is saying that you, we'll call you Reuven, you are the owner of, again, half the Eved, and that's not coincidental. That's part of a divine plan. And it's meant to be such that this mitzvah of Piri of Arivia is now knocking on your door. We don't know why, what is the reason, you know, there's some sort of special reason why you were chosen to undertake this mitzvah financially and suffer the loss therein. And therefore, says the Ger Rebbe to the socher, to the maskir, excuse me, your socher is your socher. And Ashgacha Pratis invited him to be your renter. And now you are mitzuva, you have this exclusive mitzvah, the moral response, the moral obligation that's incumbent upon your shoulders to protect the renter and support him and see to it that he has a roof over his head. We don't fall back on the community and obligate the community as a whole, and the reason for that is because you were chosen for this mitzvah. You know, we tend to think in life that situations arise coincidentally. You don't have to be at this place at that time and so forth and so on. And we take a step back. You know, the maskir, the renter, the Baal Bais is taking a step back and he's saying, well, let's look at the overall situation. Here's a Jew who needs help financially. I'm no more responsible for that, for ameliorating his financial difficulties, than anyone else in the community. Why should this mitzvah fall on me alone? And the answer is, says the Ger Rebbe, that's how Ashgacha set it up. The divine providence put you in that unique situation in which he came to you, he's your renter, and he said, please don't throw me out. You know, I realize I have a debt that's outstanding. I'll try to make good for it. But right now I need a roof over my head. So there's a whole ethical revolution going on over here that underlies this halacha, why the owner of the Eved, in that case of Chatzi Eved, Chatzi Ben Chorin, has to shoulder the burden of all of the expenses and the financial loss of freeing his Eved. Why? Simply because the problem of the Eved sort of rolled into his lap. It knocked on his door. In Hebrew we would say hitgalgala lepitcho. And now we can swing back to our parsha here in Bahar. It says ki yomuch achicha v'chzakta bo. And here we want to learn a pasuk in Mishlei and a Medrash Rabbah. Hadol d'chsiv, says the Medrash, there's a pasuk that says, Oni v'rosh nifgishu, osa kulom Hashem. When there's a meeting and encounter between a poor person and a rich person, then who set this up? Who is the one, the secretary, who organized this encounter? It was Hashem. That's the pasuk in Mishlei. And the Omer, the pasuk goes on to say, Rosh v'ish techachim nifkishu, me'ir enei shneim Hashem. Now, what's this me'ir enei shneim Hashem? Hashem sort of enlightens them. What's the meaning of this enlightenment? What's the connection between these two psukim in Mishlei? One that says that the meeting between the rich person and the poor person was done by Hashem, and we see this in the next pasuk, Meir Einei Shneim Hashem. And the answer seems to be that it's not coincidental that this Ani met up with this particular Ashir. And again, the Ashir would say, well, you know, I can chip in, you know, a Shavu Pruta, and that's all I'll give you, because there's a whole community out there. But it's not coincidental that the Ani came and is dependent upon this Ashir. You know that the Chazon Ish authored a tremendous work of Hashkafa called Emunah Bitachon, and he writes that even though today we don't have prophecy, we don't have visions, you know, divinely revealed visions, even Ruach HaKodesh is very, very limited in our generation, it's a generation of Hester Ponit. Hashem is not revealed. But nevertheless, says the Chazon Ish, Hashem left us something, some sort of gilui, some sort of revelation or indication of what we're supposed to be thinking and what the truth is all about. And a way of, in a sense, revealing the Hashkocha Pratis. And that Hashkocha Pratis is going to serve for us as a replacement for miracles and for Ruach HaKodesh and for Nevuah, any sort of prophecy. And very often when a person looks at his life and the episodes therein, he begins to become aware and acknowledge that this is not coincidence. This is not what we call tziruf mikrim, you know, just a combination of events, you know, a chain of events that occurred, but rather a believing person understands that there's a connection between event A and event B, and it's all part of a divine plan, and there's Hashkocha Pratis here. And this is the Shirayim, this is like the leftover of the original Nevuah of those days, when a person looks at his life and sees how the pieces of the puzzle, cause and effect, one episode and another episode, fit into a total picture and a total pattern. If you go back to our Sinai, we received a Sefer Chukim, a book of statutes. It's called Torah Hashem. And one could, heaven forbid, define the Torah as just simply another book of statutes, a statute book. You know, every country, every nation has its laws. This is the laws for our nation. And let's just look at the law in its dry cut way and apply the law, apply the rules. So that if a Jew needs a loan because he doesn't have money to pay his bills, or he doesn't have money to invest in a very exciting business alternative, so then another person has to open up his hand and extend the loan. If he has the money, give him a loan. And this is indicative of all of our lives. The Torah is not just a Sefer Chukim, it's not just a dry book of laws, cold and mechanical. The Torah is the Torah of life. It is meant to teach us something. Everything that happens in this world is not just by chance, it's not coincidental, it's part of a divine plan. And if there is an encounter between Ploni, we'll call him Ruvain, the Ashir, and Shimon Almoni, the Rosh, the Dal, the poor person, then it must mean that this is part of a divine scheme. And when we talk about wealth and we talk about a rich person, it doesn't have to be rich in terms of his bank account. It could be rich in terms of what he knows, his knowledge. It could be in terms of his wisdom and his ability to give counsel and guidance. And the Ani is someone who is either financially down and out, he needs money, desperate for funds, or he might be an Ani B'das. He just simply doesn't know. He's never been taught. He doesn't have that wisdom, that insight, that intuition to guide himself. He needs the guide of the Ashir. And every human being, when he is in that situation of an encounter, a meeting between him and his friend, he has to be aware of the Hashgacha Pratis. There's a higher supervision here, a divine providence from above, that is guiding with a, you know, and looking down from Shamayim with an Eina Pekicha, as we call it, you know, a very perceiving eye, and setting up this meeting. HaKadosh Baruch Hu Bechodo V'Atzmo, that's what this Pasuk in Mishlei is teaching us, is the one who set up this cause and effect relationship so that this encounter would happen. It's all part of a divine plan. And what Hashem wants from this, and we don't know why, is that this particular Malveh, no, this particular potential Nosei in the Ashir, and this particular Makabel, this Ani that needs the funds, would get together and one would help the other. This was all part of the plan. So in other words, the giving of the money or the extending of the loan from Reuven to Shimon is not just a dry mechanical act, but rather it's meant to create a connection between these two human beings. The Hashgach wanted to connect them together, to bring a mifkash. And that's this pasuk in Mishlei, which the Medrash is darshaning. Ani v'rosh nivgashu, oseh kulam Hashem. HaKadosh Baruch Hu doesn't just make it such that one person is rich and one person is poor. For sure, that's part of the divine plan. But HaKadosh Baruch Hu also determines that at a certain hour, in a certain place, this Ashir and this Ani would get together. They would meet each other, encounter. A relationship is generated. And the two worlds now, the world of the giver, the donor, and the world of the receiver, now overlap and they become almost one world. And now when Reuven gives to Shimon, it's a particular type of Nesina. You know, again, it's not the same as if Levi had given to Shimon, or if Levi gives to Yehuda. Here, Reuven has to give to Shimon. And HaKadosh Baruch Hu created this encounter in a very unique, singular way between the giver and the recipient. And that's perhaps the deeper meaning in the famous Zohar, in Parshas Mishpatim. The Zohar says, Ilyin Gilgula Dedina, that there's a galgal, there's sort of like a wheel that turns, you know, the wheel of fortune, of destiny, that keeps turning and turning in this world. And what, you know, you today you're the usher and he's the Ani, tomorrow might be just the opposite. The Zohar brings various episodes in Parshas Mishpatim, the Zohar says, where the Ani needed the help of the Ashir, and after a certain period of time, the Ashir became penniless, and he needed the help of the person who used to be the Ani, and now the Ani became an Ashir. That's the Galgal here. Anius Misgalgelis. And everything now turns topsy-turvy and creates a situation of a new Ashir and a new Ani. And once again, the Ashir is meant to be Tomech, to support the Ani, but it's exact opposite personalities. And sometimes it may take generations upon generations until this thing comes to pass, but nevertheless, one has to understand that this meeting, this encounter between the rich person and the poor person, happens out of a deep, profound, divine scheme. And therefore the giving of the Ashir to the Ani, a financial extension of a loan or any sort of support, that itself is a great act which the Torah sees as the culmination of this relationship in which Reuven encountered Shimon, in which the Ashir encountered the Ani. And this is something phenomenal. It's a revolution of sorts in Bein Adam L'Chaveiro. Now, in the case of the mitzvah of tzedakah, you know, you could have been tempted to say, what is tzedakah? It's a mechanical act of giving, that's all. But if that be the case, then let's ask the following question. How much does a person have to give? There should be what we call a shiur, a standard set price that applies to tzedakah, like there is with regard to all mitzvahs. Every mitzvah has a shir. You know, what's a lulav, and what's matzah, how much I have to eat, and what do I have to shake. And what is the shir that should be objective for everyone? For tzedakah, how much you have to give? No, the Torah says no. Give 20%, or shall I say up to 20%, not more than 20%. Now, imagine the difference between a poor person giving 20% of his assets and a rich person who has millions giving 20% or up to 20% of his assets. I mean, there's a massive difference between the two. So we see clearly there's no objective shear for the mitzvah tzedak. It's all subjective. And why is this mitzvah different? Because this mitzvah is relevant not just to the nesina but to the people who are involved in the giving and the taking. There's a personal involvement here. Again, as I said before, it's not a mechanical act of nesina of giving. It's so much more profound in terms of the relationship between two people. And that's why the Torah doesn't want to set up a standard objective amount, a sum of how much has to be given for the mitzvah of tzedakah. It's got to be with a subjective element. The subjective element represents the essence of this mitzvah. And it's not just in the case of halvah, as we discussed earlier, it's also in the case of tzedakah. So we see when a person lends money to his friend, the arrangement is not simply some sort of financial arrangement. You know, let's write up a shtar, you know, I gave you 100, you'll pay me back 100. It's not just what we call in Hebrew an asek, you know, some sort of business transaction. But rather, we're talking about some sort of ethical obligation on a much more profound level. And he says that balva, he says, the malv and the lover, the lender and the borrower, are going to make a calculation exactly how much money he has to return, how much money he received, how much he has to return. And in the secular world, you know, the world of non-Jewish ethics, how much money he's going to have to pay in ribis. And now the Torah says, you know what? This is not just a transaction. This is not just X amount of money was given, X has to be returned. Oh, it's much deeper than that. It's much more profound. As we said before, there's a moral obligation here that goes beyond the monetary considerations. There is, and what's been generated as a result of this encounter that we spoke about, that mifgash is a profound connection between the malv and the loaf. We're not just looking at two humans, two mortals who get together to make an agreement. We're going down to the very roots of their relationship, of their personalities. And again, we don't know why in Shamayim there was this calculation, this was this decision that this person should get together with that person and they should have the encounter and this needs and this receives. No, we don't know that. That's beyond our understanding. That's concealed from human comprehension. But there is a connection between the poor person and the rich person, and it's a deep connection. And within the context of that connection, of that spiritual affinity between the malv and the lov, the lov has to be happy. The malv has to see to it that the lov is satisfied with the situation. And there the Torah says, Meir Einei Shneim Hashem. Hashem wants to be Meir Einayim. He opens up the eyes of the Ashir in such a way that the Ashir will understand that he is entering into a great mitzvah, he has a great opportunity here. The ani's eyes are opened up. He's not just receiving money, but there's something much more. And if you take a look, for example, in the Medrash in Rus, Yosem Mimashem Balabais Osem Ha'ani Ani Osem Balabais. It's a phenomenal concept that, you know, we think that the ani is receiving and the usher is giving and that's it. No. More than what the usher gives is what he receives. What the ani does for the Baal Bayis, giving him that opportunity to fulfill this great mitzvah of tzedakah, or in our case halva. You know, it's funny, you know, to think about it. paradoxical. The Ani is really giving the Ashir a tremendous opportunity. And again, we begin to go back to the story of the Ger Rebbe and the Baal Bayis, who's the landlord, and the Socher, who is renting the apartment. There's a relationship between the two. Or we talk about the case of the master who owns an Eved, or half of an Eved. There's a relationship here. And the obligation upon, incumbent upon the Malvet, vis-a-vis the Lova, or the Adon vis-a-vis the Eved, goes way beyond just the surface, superficial level. Because we begin to understand that there's a Mesovev Hasivos, that there's the God who is the cause of all causes, who brought these people together, the Osher and the Ani and the Masker and the Socher and the Adon and the Eved. And this deep relationship is such that within the context of Hashgacha Pratis, the Torah is telling us there's an aguda here, there's a real deep, profound connection in the context of this mitzvah between these two individuals. And therefore, the one who has to give, again, whether it's the Adon,